Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this week's episode of the Bombercast. I am Bonza 34, joined this week by the Grizz. How are you, Grizz?
I'm doing all right, mate. It's been a while since I've had a chat to you on the pod, but I had a few wins since then and a really strange draw. But, yeah, it's great to chat and I suppose good to have a sort of win on the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it was a win. It was a win against a side that I don't think is going to be as bad as what they were 12 months ago. And I don't think they're as bad as what they were at the start of the year. So I think West Coast... have always had those senior players in Elliot Yeo and even Dom Sheeder in a lesser role where they just needed them to stay fit and stay on the park and they'd be a lot more competitive than they have been. So it was a bizarre game because at times it really did look like we were just dominating but couldn't put it on the board. But we did get the 4 points, so it's always good to get a win away, especially over in Perth.
Yeah, and I suppose any away win's a good win. And just on West Coast, I was having this discussion with a friend of mine about the team, is that they've actually had a decent month at home. So when you think about they lost to Gold Coast in Gold Coast pretty badly, but before that they belted Fremantle in the derby. They beat Richmond at home, and then I think they lost to Sydney in there as well in Sydney, which was a bad loss, but most teams are going to get run afoul by Sydney in Sydney. So they've been a pretty competitive team, and yeah, I think this is not the chalk-in buy that it was the last couple of years. And to be honest, I think outside of North Melbourne, I don't think there is one of those really poor teams. I think Hawthorn and West Coast have both improved. West Coast on the back of Yeo. And, you know, we talk about the midfield and Yeo and Kelly that got them back into the game in the second half. McGovern and Barris being fit, Jack Darling being fit, Jake Waterman. Looks like Wayne Carey over the last month. I think he's kicked 18 goals in 4 games. He's having a really good season. Like, this is a better team than what people would expect, as you said. And I tend to have this theory, Bonce, that teams like West Coast see us coming as a club and think we're a chance to be upset. So I think if they were to play Sydney or something in West Coast, they probably would be half defeated by the time they get to the ground. But I think we find ourselves in this position where we just scrape by these teams because they know we'll give them a chance with the way we play. And we had a good start to the game and a good first half, but we didn't take toll, I think, for clearances when we were dominating them and allowed them back in the game when their midfield got on top.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I know Eath has put up the stats quite regularly and he hasn't done it for a while, so I don't know what they are off the top of my head. But there was this theory that we lost to bottom teams, but the reality was we actually won the majority of our games. It was the top teams that we couldn't beat. So I get there's that theory, and it certainly does feel like that at times, but yeah, I'm just not sure. Just not sure how accurate it is. I guess it depends on how we beat these teams. We tend to only sort of fall over the line, don't we, as opposed to putting them away by 10 goals.
That's more my point, I think. We scraped by West Coast last year, scraped by North a couple of times last year. We don't tend to blow these teams out of the water.
But we did beat West Coast by 50 points over there last year, though, I think. It was a pretty solid victory first time round.
Yeah, I think the second time round, it took a Kyle Langford goal in the last minute to go over the top of them. But in saying that, like I said, this is not the same West Coast that has been the last few years. And they've got a couple of really promising young players as well coming through. But any discussion of this game has to start with Zach Merritt, I think, who was just like, we're running out of things to say about Zach Merritt, to be honest. Like, he's just been absolutely brilliant all season, backed up the Anzac Day medal with 29 disposals, 3 goals, a bunch of clearances and tackles. Like, he was just, whenever West Coast was starting to get momentum, Bonce, I felt like Zach, kicked a goal or set another one up or laid a big tackle, won a hard ball. It's just he was the one man sort of dam that was preventing the wall from breaking, I feel, in that third quarter.
Yeah, he definitely did stand up when we wanted it. And he kicked, two goals on his right foot? Which is fair effort and does sort of lead to the theory that maybe he's not as heavily one-sided as he has been previously. Normally you'd see him do those U-turns and swing back, but I think that's another element he's probably added to his game that's gone unrecognized this year. That's his right foot. I think he's a lot more prepared to turn on the right and try and hit that kick as opposed to the big U-turn where he inevitably gets cleaned up as he swings around.
One thing I've very appreciated about Zach this year is his work in the clearances, and he's not playing for free kicks as often as he did maybe not last year. I think he was pretty good last year, but the years before that, he's really focused on the ball and team stuff, and it's filtrating throughout the team. And I feel like the midfield in general had a pretty good game, or at least an excellent first half. We were absolutely belting them in the clearances throughout the first half. I think the clearances basically levelled out over the course of the game as West Coast's midfield got back into it. But, you know, Darcy Parrish got his usual numbers, but still, you know, had 6 clearances and 5 tackles, which shows that he was doing all the hard stuff, not just the cheapies out the back. Still had some foot, disposal issues at points, but his disposal efficiency was still relatively good. And then, you know, Sam Durham's a revelation. I feel like he's been absolutely outstanding this year, and we're not the first one to come up with that revelation. But generally, the midfield had a pretty good day out, at least for the first 2.5-3 quarters.
So Zach Merritt, just going back to him for a second, he's now 11-2 against in games where he's kicked 2 or more goals. Which team do you reckon the two are against? Which team has he lost to when he's kicked 2 goals? One of them was earlier this year, so that's a bit of a hint.
Well, he kicked 3 against Sydney, or 2 against Sydney earlier this year.
It's 2 against Sydney this year, right? So it was Sydney in round 20, 2021, and then round 3, 2024. When he kicks 3 or more, we're currently 3-0. So if Zach kicks 3, then we can pretty much write it down in the book as a win.
So that's the old tipper stat, wasn't it? Whenever he kicked, like when he kicked a goal, our record was ridiculous. So what you're saying is Zach Merritt lead out full forward from now on.
Well, I mean, we are looking for that small forward because I think Alwyn Davey Jr. has struggled a little bit in that role, and we don't really like Shiel there, and Perkins has moved into the midfield, so we really want him back at the forward line. I mean, we've tried Zach on half-back flank and on the wing, and we actually did play him as a small forward early in his career, and he wasn't too bad at it, so you never know.
Yeah, I'm going to pass on that, I think. I'm happy to pinch hit him forward, and I think you're joking, but just in case you're not, we don't think he should be a small forward.
Well, I mean, it was always the old, when Gary Ablett runs out of legs, we'll throw him forward because he'll still kick 50 goals, which obviously didn't eventuate because when he ran out of legs, it turned out he ran out of legs. It doesn't matter how good you are when you lose your pace and you're that sort of size, it does become very difficult. But you are right about the rest of the midfield. So Darcy Parrish and obviously Sam Durham again dominated. We will talk about Duz just quickly though. So I made a comment during the game that I think his exuberance just needs to is good. When we want to see that attitude, we want to see him up and about, but he just has got to learn to just probably dial it back a notch. So not be quite so over the top. And I think I said sloppy during the maybe you said sloppy and I said he was undisciplined or vice versa. I can't remember who said what, but it was something like that because he did give away some pretty silly stuff on Saturday night.
Yeah, I think the words you used was his exuberance is great, but he needs to tighten up a few things or something along those lines. And look, I want to preface this by saying Sam Durham does, of what Sam Durham did on the weekend, 90% of it was excellent. It was almost like a 6-minute period, wasn't it, where he gave away 2 free kicks, ended downfield.
Yeah, he just seemed to get angry and then just compounded the issue, didn't he?
Yeah, the red mist seemed to set down, and there was this 5 or 6 minute period where there was a downfield which resulted in the goal and 2 free kicks. So I think most of them were against Harley Reid, who by the end of the game was getting under a few player skins, to be honest. But he just got the red mist there, and that was, you know, those 2 or 3 goals that resulted in the next 10 minutes were really costly. Margin was only a goal. So he's a young player. So we seem to forget he was a mid-season draft pick. So he's came in at 20 years old. He's only been on the list for 3 years. Yeah, he's probably, 50-odd games, maybe less. Like, this is a learning curve. And I imagine he'll probably watch the game back and see that he probably just lost his mind a little bit there in that 5 minutes. But the better thing I thought, Bonds, and I'll let you continue talking because you raised us as a point, was the last 10 was excellent. So he recovered from that and was able to screw his head back on and helped us, you know, seal the win.
Yeah, so he's played 56 games now. So his 50th game was earlier this year. He's 26-1-29, so he's not at a positive winning record yet, but hopefully by the end of the season he's managed to catch those 3 up and it'll be a positive winning result. It's actually amusing still because 25 touches that he had on the weekend is still the highest he's had in the game. So that's been his peak so far. And to be honest, I don't think you're going to see many more. I don't think he's ever going to be that 35 touch a game. Like, there may be a game here or there, sort of like, I guess, Gary O'Donnell back in the day. You could always bank on Gary getting 25 touches comfortably, and then occasionally he'd turn up and get 35 or 40 and you'd be amazed. So I think that's the kind of midfielder we're hoping for because we do have our accumulators already. So you can't have 3 accumulators in the side. If you do, you're overusing the ball, which I think we've seen with the Bulldogs lately where they just dominate the possession but can go absolutely fucking nowhere.
And I think that's what we had with Merritt, Shield and Parrish, wasn't it? We had three guys that were not all that defensively minded, but were accumulators. And like you said, it was high numbers, ring a ring a Rosie, not really going anywhere. You know, 25 disposals, but 7 clearances. So when he does win the football, it's effective. And he does a lot of defensive stuff that our other mids rely on him for. Jai Caldwell does a lot of it as well. Like you can see him at stoppage start on a really dangerous midfielder and just react quicker. But absolutely, he is doing a lot of defensive stuff, which means he's not going to get the numbers that Parrish or Merritt does. But I would argue he might, you know, behind Merritt, might be functionally our second most valuable midfielder.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that with Darcy and Zach this year in their meters gain. I mean, Darcy's had a couple of poor meters gained games, but again, it's the role he plays as that inside first touch mid. So you're probably not expecting him to get 400 meters gained per game, although on the weekend he did nearly crack the 500 mark. So that was very impressive. Look, I still think we've also got our unsung heroes in that midfield in Caldwell. You know, Perkins went back straight through there on the weekend, which I was very pleased to see. I was very concerned they were going to throw him back forward again. You know, Dersmer's sitting there out in the wing. Even Jake Kelly, I think it's gone to a wing at times, and I think he's been okay. Nick Cox out in the wing this year as well. It seems to have lifted. I don't think Cox has got any more disposal-wise. I'm not seeing huge numbers from him, but he's now taking some marks and putting some body on him, doing some spoils, which is sort of what you want from a bloke his size.
Him and Kelly seem to be rotating off that wing, don't they? Wing half back, wing half, depending on, and it seems almost matchup dependent. When, you know, West Coast were taller down there, when Jack Williams was getting a hold of our defense, Nick Cox was sliding back a bit more and Kelly was playing a bit more wing. So it's really interesting dynamic between those two. The thing about Nick Cox, he was playing midfield for a point, like on the ball. He had 4 clearances.
Which is unheard of for a player of his size unless they're playing right.
Yeah. But he was playing almost full-blown mid. I think he took a couple of ruck contests just because Goldie couldn't get to them as opposed to being the designated ruck. But I think this is a really promising start to the year for Nick. Like, he's not banging the door down in the sense that everyone's taking notice from, you know, best and fairest or Australian notice. But it's just good to see him string 8 games together. And not be, you know, looking like he's completely lost out there. He's looking like he's clear in his role. Looks like him and Kelly and Dersmer have this sort of really sort of understandable rotation going. And I'd be happy if this was his form line for the rest of the year and he just played 20 games, sign me up. I'd just basically rip your hand off, I reckon.
So we'll move to the back line because we're talking slightly about that. Now, you want to talk about Jaden Laverde. I'm just going to preface this by saying I actually thought he played all right on Saturday night. I said it on the board. I've said it a couple of times and I'll say it again. The couple of goals Waterman kicked and that third shot that he was going to get before Jamie Cripps with one of the great brain fades turned the kick over.
Yeah.
They came from marks where I just don't know what else Laverde could do. Like he got out on the lead. He took some great grabs. And unless you're Dustin Fletcher, I mean, how are you sometimes you just get beaten. Sometimes a forward, you wear them like a glove like Laverde did, and they still just take the mark. It happens. You can't win every contest.
No, and I think I posted in the post-game thread that Waterman's kicked 18 goals in the last 4 games now. So it's not like he got worked over by someone that it's some scrub.
It's not like Lacroix kicked 12 against us never got – and whilst Lacroix was a good player, never looked like kicking 12 ever again.
Yeah. So this isn't him getting worked over by a scrub. Jake Waterman's probably one of the form forwards of the competition over the last 5 to 6 weeks. And I want to agree with you. I didn't think he played that badly. Of the 3 goals Waterman kicked, only 2 of them were on Laverde, and there were those 2 marks that you were talking about where I'm probably more upset at the midfield at how the ball came in than I am upset at Laverde and not being able to defend it. But I just wanted to have – and just on Laverde, he had a couple of really crucial contests late where he bodylined the ball and a couple of West Coast guys had a second look and he won a couple of really crucial contests that turned into rebound 50s, you know, when the game was, you know, a goal or a bit over a goal.
He also flattened Waterman during that third quarter, which I thought was fantastic. There was a boundary throw-in and Waterman sort of half-stepped back because he was going to take the ball over the line and Jaden just ran straight over the top of him, which was hilarious to watch.
But I just wanted to have the general discussion because whilst he played okay on the weekend, the month before that was worrying. Like, Mayocek absolutely worked him over. And on Anzac Day, I think if Mayocek had kicked any straighter, It would have looked really, really bad. And I wonder with Jaden, and I'm really happy to have this discussion generally, is that he's such a lion-hearted player, but he look for a guy that's 28, 29, he looks like he's 32, 33. I don't know what it is about the way he moves.
I mean, that comes down to his injuries, though. I mean,
that's it.
The fact that he's out there is almost a medical miracle at times.
Yeah, yeah, but he seems like when the ball hits a deck, his mobility and his agility is like, are we getting to the point where, you know, at least we've got obviously Lewis Hayes in the background, Zach Reed, if he was fit, might have been playing over the top of him. Do we need to be worried about Jaden, or is this just had a couple of really bad matchups in the last month and, you know, with the midfield putting more pressure on, he'll be okay?
So you talk about Zach Reed, who is actually a test this week. So you imagine he would play VFL rather than rushing him back into the AFL. And the reality is at the start of round one this year, Jaden wasn't getting a game, so they were picking Zach Reed over him. So yeah, it does sort of feel like once Reed is back and played, say, 2 or 3 weeks in the VFL, that he'll most likely come back up and Jaden will most likely go back down. So I think the answer is that Jaden is now a depth player in our back line. And I've been a little bit facetious at times with our back line, but I'll say it again. The thing is, he is a failed forward as such. So he was meant to be a forward. And didn't make it. So he went down back, sort of like Liam Jones. And, you know, Liam Jones became one of the premier defenders in the comp for a while. So this was not a role he was ever earmarked in our build to do. He's managed to find his way into it, but he was never earmarked to do it. And as a result, he should only ever, in my opinion, be a depth player. And that is what he is now. He is a depth player. And Lewis Hayes potentially may go past him later this year as well. So yeah, it's not so much I'm worried about him. I think now we're just probably got enough numbers around that we don't have to play somebody in a role that was never really intended to, unless a break glass in emergency. And he's been really good at it at times. Like, as I said, I thought Saturday night he was really good. But I just think his position moving forward is depth. And, I mean, you could do worse than having him as your depth key position player. Yeah, look, the thing is, if I was somebody like North, I'd look at trying to grab him for a couple of years because he'd immediately be nearly their best defender down there. Oh, like, I know they've got Griffin Logue and they talk about him all the time on North board, but, you know, him aside, I reckon Jaden's nearly their best fullback.
I worry what he would look like behind that midfield. Like, I was saying before that West Coast and Hawthorn have sort of elevated themselves above automatic win status. That North team is horrific. And that, I would hate to be, I think, you know, any defender looks bad in that back line, but I feel like North have enough of his size anyway, like Aiden Corr and
Griffin. I think he's Logue. A much better player than Aiden Corr, though.
Well, he might be.
I don't think Aiden Corr is good enough for depth, let alone play as a starting back.
I have this rule of I try not to judge defenders that play for North too harshly, considering how often and how easily that ball comes inside defensive 50 for them. But putting that to aside, the other thing we didn't talk about is Jordan Ridley. You know, if Ridley's fit, is Laverty playing as well? That's the other one that you got to think about.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Absolutely
yeah, so, not. So we're probably down a few there. I would be surprised if Zach Reed plays AFL for a month, to be honest. I would just be giving him 4 weeks at VFL level just to build that sort of resistance back. But I just want to be really clear. I love Jaden. I think the last few years he's been a really pleasant surprise for us down at fullback out of nowhere in, you know, Truck's first full year in 2020. He was sort of the find of the season down in defence, and he's done a really good job filling that vacancy over the last few years. But I just wonder if we're starting to go past him, but not on the weekend because, as we said, we thought he actually did all right. The one thing we want to touch on before we move into the injury wrap and talk about the upcoming week is I just want to talk, what do you think of the one ruck setup? I liked it. I thought we were far more mobile at ground level up forward. We put good pressure on. We're making able to get repeat entries as a result. What do you think? So Draper obviously missed, and we'll talk about Sammy in a second. Did you like the setup? Did you not? Did you think that Goldie probably by the end was flagging a bit? But, you know, what's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so Goldie obviously was struggling to run out the game by the end. And as a result, I don't think he plays this week. So I think Goldie gets rested this week and Draper comes in and we run the same structure again. And I think the issue we've got is that you take Draper back in and you put Goldie out. The thing is, Peter Wright's back. So if you're playing, I've been pretty vocal that I just don't see how you play Goldstein, Draper, Wright, Harry Jones, Langford, Stringer. I mean, Langford to a lesser degree because he's pretty agile for a guy his size. I mean, there was that big, let's make him an inside mid push for a while. So he, which didn't not work because of his agility. It just didn't work because he's a much better, he's a Bailey Fritsch style forward. So I think you could probably leave Langford out of the conversation, but Stringer, Jones, Wright, and then arresting Ruckman is just way too slow. It's just not going to work, and I don't think it works, and I'll be interested to see how they try and make it work. My biggest fear is that Harry gets pushed out because I'm just he just hasn't adjusted well to Wright being back, I don't think, and that's not his fault because the problem is he's in the same spots as Peter Wright, and at this point in time, they're not going to drop Peter Wright for Harry Jones. So it'll be interesting to see how this all unfolds. But if they can get them all in one side of working, then fantastic. But I don't think sending Goldie to WA on that massive ground is the best idea we've ever had.
Yeah, well, I suppose it depends on our next topic, which is Sammy Draper, and whether you think Sammy was actually injured or whether that was a cover for some other extracurricular activities. And I don't mean drug use, as some might be suggesting with the Melbourne Football Club story, but rather his podcast. And, you know, we're not anti-podcast here, obviously, but, you know, we'll jump
I'll be honest, mate. I'll be honest. I could not give a flying fuck what he said on that podcast. Could not care less. I mean, for starters, it was a segment where they were pretending to be journos with big inside news. So he was taking the piss for a start. And secondly, who really cares? Like, I mean, if the Dogs get upset by it, that's their problem. It's not our problem.
Yeah, so there's a couple of contextual things that we just want to talk about here, which is, like you said, it was him pretending to be a journo in a segment they were doing. The second thing is, this was like a month ago. I read that like the comments were made in a podcast 3 or 4 weeks ago. It only resurfaced because Nick Larkey did that interpret, like that sort of like impersonation of Damien Barrett on the podcast, and so everyone thought it was hilarious and went back and listened to previous episodes and found it. So, you know, not great for their podcast if it takes 3 weeks for such notoriety to catch up with them. But I thought it was a storm in a teacup. I understand why the club apologized, but making him stand down from his podcast almost indefinitely, I think it ended up being a month. It was going to be indefinitely. And if there is some form of link to him not playing on the weekend because of it, I just thought that's ridiculous. And if the Bulldogs are put off by Sam Draper saying something in a podcast 3 weeks ago that every man and his dog have been saying, or just about every other media outlet available.
I mean, I don't even know how Luke Beveridge has survived today. I'm stunned he's still that job.
Well, the idea that players are going to request a trade if Barrett's not there, that's been talked about just about every football show I can think of.
I'll just correct you. You mean Beveridge, not Barrett.
So no.
You said Barrett. You said if Barrett's not there. Maybe if Barrett's going to be at any club.
Well, so I got confused because, like I said, that the podcast, they found the segment because someone impersonated Barrett on that podcast and so people went back and listened to it. Yeah, sorry. If Beveridge isn't there, then if Beveridge is there, then I would have thought it's been commonly talked about that.
Well, Bailey Smith's gone, isn't he?
Bailey Smith, Baylor Dale, Caleb Daniel, like a bunch of players.
I'd throw a thing at Jack McRae, to be honest, but that's just
Jack McRae as well. So, like, this isn't groundbreaking.
No, storming a teacup. I fully agree.
If this sort of threw Beveridge and the Dogs off guard, they've got bigger problems.
So while we're talking about storms in teacups, let me just throw to you another piece of Essendon media that's come out this week, and it's something that's just made me laugh my ass off. Harley Reid. Supposedly we're going to make a massive offer. I think us and 9 other Victorian clubs and probably about 7 other interstate clubs other than West Coast are all going to throw massive offers to Harley Reid based on what we've seen.
Oh, it wouldn't just be the Victorian clubs. If you're Sydney or GWS, of course you are.
There's 9 other Victorian clubs alongside us, 7 other interstate clubs that will all be trying to get him away from. I mean, even Fremantle will have a crack at him because he's already in Perth, so why not? But leaving the fact aside, I think we both agree that Tom Morris used that as a headline grabber rather than basing it on actual fact. Actually, somebody said he probably based it on the fact that Harley stopped to have a chat with some of the boys on the ground after the game, which was interesting because he did seem to get under their skin, but then post-game they were very, very chatty. But I think that's just AFL now. What would you give up for him? What would be your acceptable trade if you had every player and every pick available to you? What would be the minimum you'd be happy to see out the door?
Okay, so I'll answer that
question without
second.
Notice as well.
Yeah. I'll answer that after I just make two first preliminary points. The first is that this is the season that Essendon come to do it for. Essendon just has this pulling capacity media-wise in terms of clickbait. You put Essendon in the headline with any trade target, you'll not only just get Essendon supporters clicking on it, you'll get every other supporter base hate clicking on it. Like they just, the Essendon brand sells like hotcakes with this sort of stuff, which is, I imagine, a major reason Tom Morris mentioned us as opposed to any of the other 17 clubs are going to be having a dig for him. Like, of course you'd name Essendon and not North Melbourne. Like, who gives a rat's what North is doing, or St Kilda or whatever. The second thing is Harley Reid, played for a VFL team at different points last year. Was it last year or the year before?
It was last year.
So he might know a bunch of the VFL younger players from that experience as well. So he might just be catching up from that. But to answer your question, there's two answers to it. The first answer is, from a realistic standpoint, it's cost prohibitive to trade for him this year. There is literally no incentive for West Coast to trade him. He's got two more years on his contract. If he wants to request this trade this year, they just keep him for a year. If he's still unhappy, he's still got a year left on his deal and they'll get a premium sort of return for him next year. It's not happening. Don't get your hopes up. Just let it go.
Yeah. I mean, we all know it's not going to happen.
Yeah. But in your theoretical scenario, what would I give up? I'll work off the Jason Horton Francis value, which was essentially a top two pick, another first rounder, and some swapping of later picks. I think you're looking at three firsts and a second minimum. I think that's to get West Coast attention, that's probably where you're starting. Because that's basically 150% value of Jason Horne-Francis. And I think Jason Horne-Francis had some strange, I'm not going to call it bad media. It was some strange media. The obsession with him, particularly with a couple of journos, was weird. And it was a talk about the ice bath and, him. And he had some family stuff wanting to go back to Adelaide. So I'm not entirely sure if that's the perfect marker. But, 150% of that value would put him at, three firsts and a pretty high value second is, I imagine, what you would need to turn West Coast head, and I'm not even sure that's enough. What would you trade for? What's the minimum you would trade? What's the maximum minimum, whatever you said?
So your two first and your two seconds, I think, are immediately on the table. I'm always reluctant to do the three first thing because it's just never been done before. Counter argument is, there's never been a player like him on the market. Well, maybe, but at the same time, I'm not sure. Because, I mean, I know North got 2, 3 and that future first, but they obviously gave up pick one alongside Jason to get that in. So, and then they got there's a whole bunch of late picks as well.
It's a weird value because it was a 14 deal and there's things fly everywhere.
So, look, two firsts is obviously the starting point. I'd be more than happy to throw in two firsts and a couple more picks. And then you start, anything more on top of that, I think you're starting to get a little bit ridiculous. And largely because it doesn't happen today. I remember when Melbourne traded Luke Jackson, and because he was such a unique player, there was talk that Fremantle were going to have to give up three firsts or whatever. It was Jesse Hogan when he got traded from Melbourne. I mean, he was a 21-year-old, 50-goal-a-year key position forward, so an absolute gem at the time. Now, I know that didn't work out, but that's irrelevant to the discussion. And I think he went for maybe two firsts. I don't think they got much more than that out of him. I can't recall, but it certainly wasn't the.
It was like pick six and a good second, like pick six and 20 or something for Jesse Hogan.
So you look at that and you go, well, okay, he's worth more than Hogan. So two firsts is a good starting point. You build from there. I don't think in realistic terms it takes much more than that because, the fact is we just don't trade heaps of firsts for players. And the other point, I suppose, is the clubs can't do it at the moment with only able to trade 1 year in advance. When we are able to kick that up a gear, I'm sure at some stage we'll see a player getting traded for a first and two future firsts. But until that happens, it's just not a possible thing. So, I'd say two firsts and probably your 2 seconds at some point, but you'd try and trade back in. But that was my little hypothetical question without notice. We do, of course, want to talk about the Twilight game this week. And ironically, the man that I think is going to be a big task for us is the one I just mentioned when he was traded from Melbourne to Fremantle. He's now at the Giants. That is, of course, Jesse Hogan. Because hasn't he come into some serious form the last 18 months or so with the Giants? I mean, when he got traded there, it was very much a last chance saloon, and he's absolutely taken it with both hands.
Yeah, I think he's one facet of what's been a really impressive forward line for GWS. I would argue they're probably the most balanced team in the competition. I know they've got a few injuries at the moment in the back line, but when they're fit, I think the mix of talls and smalls they have at both ends, the powerful midfield, that is one terrifying unit. Jesse Hogan's kicked 24 goals, 10 this year. He's spearheading it. So he's averaging, you know, 3 goals, 1 a game. You know, Ben McKay's got a big job ahead of him this week. And, yeah, you've got young Riccardi
Callum Brown's kicked 15 this year as well. So as a small forward.
He's not really small. He's like 188 centimeters, 95 kilos. But he's not playing this week, obviously, with the 3 week suspension.
No, he's not. So you take him out of that forward line. It does make them a little bit less dangerous, although they still have Toby Green in that forward line. And any player, anytime you've got Toby Green, yeah, you got to be careful. So I think you're right, though. I think McKay goes to Hogan. Who goes to Green? I'm not sure you send McGrath. I don't think McGrath's got the strength to go with Green.
No, I think Jake Kelly is your Toby Green matchup. I think you're not going to have someone that's got the functional strength at Toby Green's size. You need someone with the tank and the reach. You almost need, you know, a wily tall, to be honest, so you can outreach him and run with him on the ground. But
I mean, you send Cox back to him. Him and Cox could rotate. Kelly,
yeah,
and Cox.
I think that's what it'll be. It'll be Kelly, and then, you know, Mason Redmond might take him for stretches. But
yeah, it's a good call.
I think it will probably be Kelly will be the matchup, and then, you know, Redmond or Cox or whoever's rotating back there for Kelly when he goes to the wing will take him. But there's no good matchup for he's one of those players where it's damage minimization as opposed to completely taking him out of a contest. I think, you know, obviously we've got to talk about last time we played. It was, I think, the rock bottom moment of the last 5 years for this football club.
Well, Zach Merritt said on the weekend. Zach Merritt said on the field after the game that they embarrassed us, which really struck me as interesting that he took the time to say we got embarrassed by next week's opponent as he was celebrating a victory.
Yeah, and yeah, on field it's as bad as we've looked in 10 years, that game. That was horrendous. And we've had some terrible teams, and that includes the Asada 2016 year. Like, that was insipid. And so I would hope there's a fire in their belly to, you know, I don't expect them to win this. I'm tipping GWS, but they can't get belted again. They just, whatever happens, they can't get belted again.
No, I'd be disappointed if we got belted again. And while we're talking about matchups, so we talk about Hogan and Green and that end, but at the other end, you've got Sam Taylor, who's one of the best intercept players in the league.
He's not playing.
Well, there you go.
He's been injured for a few weeks, I thought.
I thought he was back. I thought there was rumors he was back this week, but
If he is back, I was saying corrected, but I thought he was injured. If he is back this week, that's terrible for Peter Wright.
But, so that was my question. That was going to be my question. Yeah. So if he's back this week, do you say to Peter or Harry or whoever's on him, just run up the ground and play decoy?
Well, Sam Taylor plays a Jeremy McGovern role. Like, he uses his opposition is a reference point, but he's one of the better intercepts and halfbacks in the game. If Peter Wright just leads up the ground as a decoy, Sam Taylor will let him get 30 touches on the wing all he wants, but he's not going to follow him up there. So the matchup we will want is Kyle Langford, because, you know, we honour Kyle in the lead, and the more you honour Sam Taylor's opponent, the less he zones off, and that's how you can sort of maximise your entries going into fifth side 50 by, you know, making his opponent the one you play through. So he's got to honour that assignment defensively. If you just run up to wing hoping to play decoy, he's not going to follow you. So I think I would like the matchup to be Langford, but I imagine he'll go to right and just use him as a reference point to intercept. But there's matchups everywhere on that. Let's be honest, Fonz. This game will be won and lost in the midfield. If our midfield we've dominated clearances all year. We have to do that again this week, or we're going to get absolutely belted.
Yeah, you're right. We do have to that dominate the midfield. And I know you're tipping GWS. Look, I don't want to do it, but I am going to tip Essendon because I just like to see us get up and have a win. I'm actually leading the board footy tipping at the moment alongside Monty and Law. So I did inquire to Chief this week if I could get Monty banned, would he be able to put his tips in? And the answer is no. So if anyone sees a post from Monty running around that looks bannable, just flick me the PM and I'll chuck a report in, and then I'll have to work something out with Law because I don't think you can get her banned. But Grizz, that it will do us for tonight, mate. We've run out of time. As always, we've gone right to the last minute. So thank you again for joining in.
Thanks, mate. Good to chat again.
Yeah, and as always, guys, remember to like, subscribe, and tell all your friends about us.